Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. Join me, Philip Nguyen, a scholar of Vietnamese-American culture, and the cast and crew as we discuss the making of this historic series. Subscribe now to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts and stream HBO's The Sympathizer starting April 14th exclusively on Max.
Come on, get
it
off!
A bank is pillaged.
Coins left on the floor, trays turned upside down. The vault was in complete disarray.
And its president goes missing.
Last night, the bank in Knoll was robbed. We can't seem to locate your husband.
Oh, no.
Miles away in the swampy shallows, a gruesome clue surfaces.
The body was still attached to the chair.
That was just heinous. I mean, it was just unthinkable.
And as quick as a gator's blink, detectives are mired in a deadly mystery.
They interviewed everybody.
Who could have done this? Only the swamp knows for sure. The Grand Lake of the Cherokee stretches like a snake in the shadow of the Ozark Mountains at the junction of Oklahoma, Missouri, and Arkansas.
There's water snakes everywhere. A lot of times if you're in a boat going down along the shore or under the trees, you gotta watch it, you'll see one hanging.
The narrow inlet of Elk Cove is especially murky, which is why this area, around the Cowskin Bridge, is an ideal spot to make someone disappear.
Wait,
all right, together?
Don't do this, I've got kids!
He's trying to! Come on!
Oh, let's go! Do it, don't do it!
No!
It's a regular Friday here in the small blue-collar town of Knoll, Missouri. Population just south of 1,200. Pauline Coonrod is about to start her workday.
Pauline Coonrod was the secretary of the State Bank of Knoll, who normally opened up, more or less ran the day-to-day operations along with the president, Dan Short.
She got there and she seen that the doors was unlocked and that the keys in the bank were open.
The building alarm seems to be turned off, and that's worrying. Pauline knows only a handful of employees have that code.
Oh, my Lord.
The bank had been robbed.
Oh, my Lord.
Pauline first notified the owner of the bank, Don O'Brien, initially.
This is Pauline down at the bank. We've been robbed.
At which point they then called Lou Keeling, the county sheriff, who arrived on the scene.
At 9 o'clock, the investigation's underway.
Any bank robbery is a federal crime, so the sheriff's department calls in the FBI from Kansas City, and the lead fed on the case is Special Agent Liddell Farley.
The first thing we saw on the floor in front of the doors was two spent .45 casings.
Apparently they had shot the cameras out, and I think they spray painted.
The camera has also been re-aimed inward, which due to height means this was likely not just the work of one person.
Given that the camera was some 10 feet from the floor, in order to reach the camera, someone had been hoisted up by another individual to gain that access. In doing so, that person left smudges on the wall.
Hey, I look like a palm smudge to you? Huh?
Small one, yeah.
Let's go.
After checking the front area, Agent Farley and the others shift their attention to the bank's main safe.
You finding anything, officer?
It's a mess. They even took the pennies.
Unbelievable.
The vault had been rummaged through, pillaged, coins left on the floor, trays turned upside down. The vault was in complete disarray.
How much do you think they got away with?
Ain't no telling.
They took $71,000.
$34,000 of which was in $100 bills. Some $8,000 was in coins. We estimated that that amount of coins would have been contained in approximately 8 or 9 canvas coin bags.
Think it's smart to walk out with, what, 50, 60 pounds of coins with them?
Now, that's a lot of pounds to carry. I wouldn't have taken them. I would have got the paper money and equity coins.
Yes, yeah? Yes.
Approximately what time were you here this morning?
Oh, about 8:30.
Meanwhile, Sheriff Keeling talks with bank employees, especially anyone who could have disabled the alarm.
Are you the only one who has a key to this
No, the president, Dan Short, he has the other key.
Is this routine for Mr. Short to be late or missing?
No, he's the president of the bank. He's always here.
They followed up and contacted all the bank employees, and the one they couldn't find was Dan Short.
Let's go get him. Got an address?
Dan lived in a house some 15 miles from the bank. When Sheriff Keeling went to the residence of Dan Short looking for him, they found that his truck was missing, as was he.
It's more than a little troubling, especially because the robbery has the markings of an inside job.
We explored all possibilities at that point. One was that Dan Short himself was involved and had absconded in his truck. Another was that Dan Short was taken hostage at his residence, taken to the bank, and his whereabouts were unknown.
Is it possible Dan Short is behind the theft of his own bank? To those who know him, the idea is absurd.
He was respected in the community, was not the type of person who would render or be of any threat to anyone.
He was a well-liked guy, kind of a quiet in nature. He liked to go to the ball games and stuff.
But now Dan Short is the president of a bank that's been robbed by someone with keys and the alarm code. So investigators need to find him, and fast.
A search was organized fairly quickly, and there was about 30 or 40 volunteers for that.
Most of the officers were out in the area combing the countryside for Dan Short or his truck.
They tried to track credit cards, be sure he wasn't spending money, and it's nowhere to be found.
Sheriff's Office.
Deputy Schlesman.
Agent Farley.
As police comb the area for the missing bank president, news of the heist hits the town like a tornado. All sorts of tips start coming in from folks just trying to help out.
No, ma'am, I don't think Elvis had anything to do with this. Okay, third Elvis sighting this week.
What color was the truck? And nobody there recognizes it? Thank you very much. Hey, Don, I think we may have found our red truck.
Really?
Mr. Short's truck was left next to a vacant building to the west of Noel, some 3 or 4 miles, on the premises of an ongoing business whose employees discovered the truck.
There's a lot of change taken with it, rolls and nickels, and some of those items were found in the back of the truck.
Looks like Dan's truck was used in the robbery, but there are no fingerprints or blood that might tell investigators what happened or who was involved.
We conducted an extensive manhunt in the proximity around where his vehicle was found and expanded it on out.
While the search continues, Liddell Farley tracks down Dan's estranged wife. Joy Short lives up in St. Louis with their teenage daughter, Melanie. Their son is away at college.
So, why exactly are you here?
Mrs. Short, it seems that last night the bank in Knoll was robbed.
What?
What's more important, we can't seem to locate your husband.
Oh, no.
She and Dan had been married some 20 years and had been separated some year and a half. And as I understood it, that was by Joyce's choice.
Joyce says she has no idea about any robbery or where Dan might be now.
Anyone? Anything?
Mom,
or any
I'm home.
Is that your daughter?
Yes, this is Melanie.
You know, would you mind if I spoke with her too?
Of course.
Well, is that right if I do it privately?
Sure. Sure.
When Agent Farley questions 17-year-old Melanie Short, he learns some disturbing things.
I'm afraid I have some bad news.
Dan's daughter, Melanie, did state that her father had been drinking too much in the days prior to this.
You noticed any reason why he would do that?
Yeah, he told me he would have to do something immoral at the bank or get fired.
It's an odd thing to say to your daughter. And Agent Farley decides they'd better dig a little deeper into Dan Short's past. They start by examining his banking practices.
These numbers just aren't adding up.
He got along fairly well with people. Of course, being the business he was in, when people didn't pay their loans and he tried to collect, I'm sure there was some animosity generated there. There always is.
This is Agent Farley down at the Bank of Knoll. I was wondering if you guys had come up with anything yet?
They expect to find some disgruntled bank customers. But what they don't expect is that recently, Dan has been under investigation by banking regulators.
You don't say. All right. Thanks so much. It looks like Mr. Short is in a spot of trouble.
At the time of this crime, there were some questionable loans, that being maybe loans outside of the normal policy of good lending practices, which more than anything else put Dan in the bad light with the owners of the bank. There's nothing illegal about those loans. They were just simply outside of the lending practices.
He was going in after hours and trying to see who was behind and who was paying and stuff like that.
He had loans out to people who may have had problems paying them back. Perhaps one of them got angry and took it out on the bank president.
Do you think it's somebody who couldn't pay, who grabbed Short to get the cash?
Or Short was in on it. I mean, he was on the hot seat too.
Maybe it was somebody that he turned down for a loan, somebody looking to get even.
I'm sorry, your income doesn't support it.
We looked at the possibility of retaliation or vengeance against Dan's management of the bank. None of that developed. If anything, he was probably too lenient with the management of the bank's assets.
To investigators, it doesn't look like Dan was the victim of an angry customer. Instead, is it possible that Dan Short shorted his own bank by $71,000?
Of course, at that time, we didn't know. It's one of the darnest things I ever got involved in.
Coming up, when a body surfaces.
He was alive and conscious when he was thrown into the water.
That made an already horrible crime even worse.
Detectives start chasing a cold-blooded killer.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. Join me, Philip Nguyen, a scholar of Vietnamese-American culture, and the cast and crew as we discuss the making of this historic series. Subscribe now to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts and stream HBO's The Sympathizer starting April 14th exclusively on Max.
Hey, it's Janice from Warner Brothers Discovery. Spring is officially in bloom here in the Northern Hemisphere, and with a fresh season underway, you might be seeking your own transformation. For some, that means a new approach to weight loss or nutrition. Noom has a unique approach. Noom is tailored to each person's psychology and biology. It's built to meet you where you are because Noom understands that no two people are the same. Noom stands out to me because it offers a holistic approach to well-being. From coaching to recipes, Noom's app provides personalized information to help you on your journey. I also think it's great that Noom doesn't restrict what you can eat, and it doesn't shame you for treating yourself, and treat yourself you should. What's more, Noom believes in nourishing rather than restricting. Noom can help you lose weight while still enjoying your favorite foods, because this approach is about eating well and treating your body right. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your free trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
Whenever a bank is robbed overnight, and its senior manager is nowhere to be found, it raises eyebrows. So when thieves got away with $71,000 from the State Bank of Knoll in Missouri in the fall of 1989, the town starts buzzing with talk of missing bank president Dan Short.
Of course, everybody just in awe, you know, because he was a well-known figure in the city. And, you know, because he was everybody's banker. And they were just wondering who could have done it, who could have done it.
In the late morning after the heist, Deputy Don Schlesman finds a glaring problem with the idea that Mr. Short was one of the robbers.
Hey, Sheriff. Agent Farley, you might want to come look at this.
Well, they'd got in the vault and got quite a bit of money out of it, but there was about $100,000 in just a file cabinet.
Holy cow.
But they didn't find it. Short knew about it, but apparently he didn't tell them.
Why would he leave this much cash behind and take, what, you know, 50 pounds of rolled quarters with him?
Well, maybe our missing president isn't missing by choice.
What's more, Dan doesn't appear to be cash-strapped. And despite his daughter Melanie's statement that he was worried about doing something unethical, it seems more likely he was referring to his habit of overextending his bank loans.
Doesn't make any sense.
But if he didn't have reason to commit the robbery, it raises a troubling question. What if he was forced to do it?
As you can imagine, at this point, the local community was stirred up, highly concerned. Dan Short was known throughout, so there was concern about him being missing. There was concern about who had done it, and there was concern about those people were still at large.
5 days later, on October 11th, Pauline Hamm and her boyfriend Kenneth Randall are fishing over in the murky shallows of the Grand Lake of the Cherokees, 20 miles outside of Knoll.
I think we're going to have to rely on the grocery store for our fish tonight.
Mrs. Hamm and Mr. Randall were motoring out to their fishing hole.
They were hoping to snag some largemouth bass.
Maybe over by that log there would do a little bit better.
Instead, near the Cowskin Bridge, they find something gruesome.
That's not a stump. Let's try a little closer.
At first glance, they thought they had seen perhaps an early Halloween dummy thrown from the bridge.
That's a body in the water.
Floating in the water is a bloated body.
That's exactly what it is. There's a body out here in the water.
The body was in a state of decomposure, and it was obviously filled with liquid and stuff like that. It pretty bad.
They thought that was just heinous. I mean, it was just unthinkable.
The FBI and local police respond to the scene and interview Hamm and Randall.
Just start from the very beginning and tell me exactly what you found.
Well, we were out fishing, just enjoying the day, and we see this body. Oh, my God.
It's standard procedure to question anyone who discovers a body, but it's clear they don't know much.
There was never any indication or development that either Mr. Randall or Pauline Hamm were involved in any way except for discovering and reporting the the sighting of the body.
Crime scene technicians fish the body out of the water, and it's immediately clear this guy didn't just drown.
The body was still attached to the chair, which contained an old-fashioned chain hoist and a concrete block, all taped to the chair.
It's not hard to ID the body. Inside the back pocket of his pants is his wallet, still stuffed with bills, and his Bankers Association card.
Dan Short. We found him.
It was beginning to disfigure because of that time in the water and now exposure to the air. But it was obvious to all of those present that knew Dan Short that indeed was the body of Dan Short.
Crime scene investigators scour the area for evidence, packing up the chair, the concrete block, and the chains. To them, it looks like some sort of sadistic killing device.
It was obvious that Mr. Short had been taped himself to the chair in an upright position, thrown off the bridge into the lake.
An autopsy later confirms his likely time of death, 5 days earlier, around the same time of the robbery. And the story only gets worse.
The examiner's office determined that Mr. Short was alive and conscious when he was thrown into the water, and the cause of death was drowning.
That made an already horrible crime even worse, and one that you just can't hardly comprehend, just thinking about his last minutes.
Drowning was much more sadistic than most other manners, including a mere gunshot, which would be obviously quick and less painful.
A common bank robbery and missing persons case has now turned into a homicide, an especially nasty one. For a motive as simple as money, it sure is an elaborately evil way to kill a man.
Of course, the number one question was, who?
After finding the body, the FBI casts a wider net for suspects.
What about this guy?
Well, what's his record?
Robbery.
Well, bring him in. One of these has got to pay off. Somebody knows something.
They interviewed everybody. I may have been a suspect. I don't know.
But a week later, it's the Great Lake of the Cherokees that once again provides the next break in the case.
Roddy Foreman is fishing and found parts of the chair. So he bagged him up and took him home, and then he contacted the authorities.
A piece of tape was brought to my attention, which reflected greasy fingerprints on one end of the tape.
The FBI sent it to their lab and let them do the comparisons, and they determined that it was the same chair, and the tape came from the same roll. Same brand.
The fingerprints on the tape change everything. Hopes run high that it'll match up with a known criminal in the FBI database.
At that point, the fingerprints were very classifiable, very good quality, so they were queried through the existing fingerprint data bank, which was barely in existence at that point.
You are kidding me.
There's no match on file.
Thanks.
Despite the setback, investigators are by no means stuck. They continue to get a steady stream of leads.
Deputy Schlesman.
Especially when they put it out that they're looking for people displaying unreasonable amounts of change.
There's a phone call that went into the Joplin Police Department from some female that said the Gosfee brothers had a lot of change.
All right, we'll be sure to follow up on that. Thank you.
It's a small town. The local police know just who she's talking about. 23-year-old Joe Agofsky actually applied once to be a reserve deputy, and his 18-year-old brother Shannon was known around town for his martial arts skills. Agent Farley sits down with the brothers to check out the lead.
I just got a few things to go over with you boys today.
The Agofsky brothers were seemingly upstanding citizens, no criminal record.
Do you own any .45 caliber weapons?
Yeah, I got two of them.
Would you be willing to turn them over to my department so we could test them for ballistics?
Sure. No problem.
Joe Ogofsky hands over his weapons to the FBI so the lab can test the guns against the shell casings found on the floor of the bank.
All right. Here they are.
They were real cooperative. They let him shoot their 45s. They let him test fire the guns.
But the authorities' hopes for quickly closing the case are soon dashed.
The two weapons were found to not be identical to those casings left in the bank.
Would agree to come down to the station.
Also, both brothers have alibis for the night of the murder.
Let's talk about October 5th.
Shannon claimed he was with his mother at her residence in Noel, Missouri, throughout the whole night after teaching a karate class.
Joe had a girlfriend that he later married, and she alibied for him.
Just to be certain, Agent Farley asked the brothers to come to the station to be fingerprinted.
Next finger.
Joe gave his prints to the FBI, and they didn't match. So that pretty well let him off the hook there.
But before Shannon can get his prints taken, investigators suddenely uncover a new lead.
An insurance policy?
And that forces the whole case to change course.
There were life insurance policies held by Mr. Short. The beneficiary was Joyce Short, his wife. She would have stood to receive those funds as well as the estate itself upon his death.
The insurance policy is worth no small figure. Suddenly, it's looking like Dan's estranged wife, Joyce Short, may have had several reasons to want her husband to disappear. 200,000 reasons, in fact.
They would have been joint property in Missouri, so the estate would have been hers without a will.
Yes, if it's
greed is a powerful motive, and if she harbored some secret grudge against her husband, it could explain the killing.
About the kids.
Could Joyce have engineered this brutal swamp murder?
A guy's wife is going to be a suspect, especially in the situation that they were in. They were separated at the time. Everybody always wonders, you know, is there any animosity there? Could this have been it?
Agent Farley returns to St. Louis to question Joyce again.
Look, I know this might be tough, but I would like to revisit your separation.
I'm sorry. We have been over this 1,000 times.
And this is how we get to the bottom of a few things.
No, doing your job would be finding the man who killed the father of my children.
Joyce balks at the personal questions.
It just wasn't working for us to be together anymore. That is all you need to know.
To detectives, there's got to be more to this failed love story. And after reviewing records at the bank, Agent Farley thinks he may have found it.
Both he and Joyce worked at the State Bank of Noel for a period of time before the separation.
Turns out, back when her husband was issuing millions of dollars worth of questionable loans, Joyce was doing clerical work at the bank. Did the couple's marriage fall apart over a shady business deal? Agent Farley informs Joyce that they'd like to question her again. This time, down at the station. Investigators ask Joyce to take a polygraph. They tell her it's just so they can rule her out as a suspect.
Yes.
Prior to this time, I wasn't too big of a fan on polygraphs. But this kind of made me a believer in him.
Have you been aware of investigations into improper loans that your husband authorized?
Yes.
Did you murder your husband?
No.
Do you have any responsibility in the death of your husband?
No.
Mrs. Short was interviewed on two occasions with the use of polygraph, both of which were indicative of deception, primarily through a question of responsibility.
The FBI decides to change the wording and brings Joyce back for a third polygraph.
No.
With the third polygraph test that Joyce Short was given, she was cleared of any involvement because she passed that one.
She explained to me that if there's any deception indication, it was simply that she did, in fact, feel responsible for having left him alone when she moved to St. Louis.
She probably felt that if she had been living with him, this wouldn't have happened, maybe.
We have gone down every dead road, and when you go down dead roads, you start back at the very beginning. That's where we
are. With Joyce off the FBI's radar, investigators need to reevaluate. They need to go back to the evidence that washed up on the muddy bank of the Grand Lake of the Cherokees and find a match for that fingerprint on the duct tape.
We need an arrest, gentlemen. This town needs an arrest.
Then 3 weeks after the bank robbery, detectives get a tip that a local woman named Anita Myers has been showing off a substantial amount of coins.
Gotcha.
It's worth checking out.
In interviewing Anita Myers, she reported they were found in shallow water. Of course, no paper wrapping, just loose coins.
So you're walking along the lake looking for arrowheads, and you just, what, see something shiny?
I sure did.
Initially, she volunteered that the amount was in the $200 area.
But Agent Farley doesn't buy her story and presses her.
Couple hundred dollars,
yeah.
Huh?
However, later on, she did finally admit that they were more like $2,000 or $3,000, but that she figured that if she's going to get in trouble for finding coins and not reporting them initially, $200 is about all the trouble she was willing to get into.
Anita's stash includes a fair amount of quarters and dimes, and at first, investigators think the swamp may have turned up another lead. But an examination of the coins reveals no evidence that matches them to those stolen from the Bank of Knoll. It's another dead end. The more time that passes, the lesser chances they'll have of solving this perplexing robbery homicide. It's been 1 month since the murder of Dan Short and the robbery of the State Bank of Knoll. And despite multiple leads, investigators are still no closer to making an arrest. But as they pore over police reports and tips that came around the time of the robbery, something catches Agent Farley's eye. A few days before the murder, a man named Wayne Boutain came to the station to report a burglary.
He goes and notifies city marshal, said, "Hey, I'm missing a set of chain falls."
According to the police report, the description matches the chain falls, also known as a chain hoist, used to drown Dan Short. In the frantic days after the murder, no one followed up. Now, Deputy Schlesman does.
I was using the chain hoist to work on my cars, and I couldn't fit it in the truck when I was moving out. And when I came back, it was just gone.
And when was this?
About a week before those robberies.
Can you tell me what it looked like?
Wayne Boutain described that chain hoist exactly as it was.
It had a particular nick out of it. And so that's how they knew that that was the same chain.
He could positively identify those chain paws as the one that had belonged to him.
With the chain coming down.
Deputy Schlesman is suspicious. Wayne could be an innocent guy whose gear was stolen. But it's also not unusual for a killer to come forward with some evidence to try and keep tabs on an investigation. And Schlesman's suspicions deepen when he considers Wayne's police record. He is not your average upstanding citizen.
I should tell you, I have a criminal record.
He admitted up front that he was a fugitive from the state of Minnesota for a probation violation on a possession of marijuana. That was an issue that concerned us greatly as to his credibility.
But Wayne insists he had nothing to do with the murder.
I'm just trying to be helpful.
We appreciate it kindly, but we do have to check out your story.
Police invite Wayne to prove his innocence by taking a polygraph.
Were you involved in the planning or the execution of the robbery of the bank?
No.
Were you involved directly or indirectly with the murder of Dan Short?
No.
He did pass the polygraph that they gave him on everything.
Still, Wayne does end up proving critical to the investigation because he thinks he knows who took his chain hoist.
But I know who did.
Oh yeah, who's that?
My neighbors, the Yagowski brothers.
Wayne Boutain was the renter of Sheila Gosky, who was the Gosky brothers' mother.
Wayne lives next door to the Yagowskis, the same two brothers who had been seen around town with a lot of change on hand just after the robbery. And they had already been questioned by police.
Wayne said he had been working on his car in Sheila Gosky's yard in front of his rental house.
The chain was hung across the fence. that they shared, and the Yagoski boys knew about it because they'd come by it a lot right there.
Finally, investigators think they're on to something.
This is good. This is very good.
The FBI conducts a thorough background check on the Yagoskis, and the results are pretty damning.
Their father had been working for some company and died in a plane crash, and I guess they had got some insurance money.
Apparently that windfall didn't last long. By the autumn of the bank robbery, Joe had run through most of his $40,000 trust, and Shannon had just turned 18. Losing his $600 a month in Social Security survivor benefits.
Those boys were looking for another jackpot. I was there all
It's night. Looking quite possible that the Yagoski brothers had the motive, and what at first had looked like ironclad alibis, in fact, were not.
Shannon was with his mother, and Joe was with his girlfriend.
And they're still holding to that?
Joe Yagoski's fingerprints didn't match the prints on the duct tape from the scene. But then investigators remember that Shannon has yet to provide his prints.
Shannon never came in.
Yeah, well, that's got to change. We have got to get a court order.
To get a warrant for Shannon's fingerprints, they need more evidence. So they ask him to take a polygraph, and he agrees. But when asked point blank about the murder...
Did you kill Dan Short?
No.
The polygraph shows no deception.
Did you steal a chain hoist from Wayne Boutain?
No.
And when Shannon denies stealing Wayne's chain hoist, the polygrapher only notes some indications of deception. It's a huge blow to the investigation. A failed polygraph would have allowed them to get a warrant for Shannon's prints. Now they've got a problem. All roads seem to lead back to the brothers. But how are they going to get Shannon's fingerprints, and will they even match?
We have got to get a warrant to get those prints, and we do not have enough evidence right now to convince a judge.
Investigators spend months and months building their case, but the Yagoski family circles the wagons, refusing to cooperate, and the investigation lags. Finally, Agent Farley digs through the Yagoski brothers' bank accounts to see if he can notice any irregularities. And sure enough, they pop up.
Following the bank robbery, Joe Yagoski spent almost $19,000 for various purchases. In fact, both Shannon and Joe had bought cars the following Tuesday after the robbery. All those expenses were paid for by Joe with primarily $100 bills.
To police, Benjamin Franklin had never looked so good. On December 12, 1990, 14 months after Dan Short was dumped in the swampy waters of Elk Cove, they get the green light.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
A federal grand jury subpoena was issued for the fingerprints and testimony of Shannon Yagoski, at which point I took his fingerprints in the office of the U.S. Marshal.
Ain't it true there's a way to beat fingerprints?
Asking that now, I bet you wish there was a way to beat fingerprints. But no, sir.
Fingerprint identification is a sure science that's not really refutable. Those fingerprints were immediately provided to the FBI laboratory.
If they match those found on the duct tape, it'll be damning evidence indeed. Meanwhile, as they wait for results on the prints, detectives interview Gant Sanders, who's being investigated for unrelated burglaries in the area.
Sanders was, of course, the same age as the Yagoskis, and they knew each other, and they ran together.
Given his connection with the brothers, the FBI presses him hard. Gant admits that back in the summer of 1989, Joe Yagoski asked him a specific favor in regards to the Bank of Knoll.
So, Gant, didn't your dad redo that bank?
Yeah, so what?
So, maybe you can get us them blueprints for it.
Since Gant's father designed the bank, it's an incriminating request, and that's not all.
Seems like it'd be pretty easy to follow an executive home and make him open a vault. Don't you think?
Really? Yeah.
But it's all hearsay from a less than credible source. Then, 1 month after Shannon's prints were taken, the analysis comes back.
I was alerted to the fact that the tape that was found by Rowdy Foreman contained two fingerprints of Shannon Agowski, a sure identification.
They were Shannon's prints.
It's the final nail in the coffin.
In March of 1992, Joe and Shannon Agowski were indicted by the federal grand jury in Springfield, Missouri.
The brothers are arrested and charged with kidnapping and federal bank robbery with the use of a firearm. And at the trial, based on all the interviews, polygraphs, and evidence collected, prosecutors reconstruct what happened that horrible night. According to his neighbors, there were loud noises outside Dan Short's home sometime around 2 a.m.
Whatever they heard could have been some kind of disturbance there at the house at the time he would have been abducted.
Wake up, Mr. President.
Joe and Shannon Agowski broke into Dan Short's home and kidnapped him at gunpoint.
Come on, wait a minute.
Witnesses say they heard a pickup truck drive away around 2:30 a.m., which means the Agowski brothers probably arrived at the bank shortly before 3.
Open this door.
With Dan as their hostage.
If I hear an alarm, you're gonna hear the sound of a gunshot and then Jesus welcoming you into his arms. Open it now. Let me get the door open. And hurry up.
After Dan got them into the bank and turned off the alarm, they went to work on the surveillance cameras. Because of the smaller hand smudge next to the camera, investigators think there may have been a third accomplice who spray painted the camera lens and turned it around.
Yep, crack her open. I know you know that combination.
Watch me.
Come on, open that door.
Get in there, get down. Don't you move, Dan.
Once inside, the brothers trashed the vault like the unprofessional thieves they were.
It was around $71,000. Rough estimate of the amount of coins they took was $8,000.
Come on, Shannon, hurry up.
But Short succeeded in one way. He didn't tell them about the additional $100,000 hidden in the file cabinet.
Get out that door before I shoot you in the face. Go.
And it appears that he was transported from there to the bridge, more than likely in a van where they could set him inside there, where he'd have room.
They drove 10 miles across the border to Oklahoma and the Grand Lake of the Cherokees. And in the middle of the Cowskin Bridge, deserted in the dead of night, the van pulled to a stop.
Come on, Dan.
Do this.
Prosecutors believe Joe and Shannon then used duct tape to bind the terrified 51-year-old to a kitchen chair, weighted down by a heavy concrete brick.
I won't tell
Dan,
anybody.
Shut
Don't
up.
Do this. Don't do
shut.
This.
Mr. Short's hands were bound together in the front with duct tape, gray duct tape. His legs were bound, and his ankle was taped to this apparatus of the chair.
At the last minute, Shannon furiously taped the chain falls around Dan Short for added weight.
They must have been in a hurry to get those on there because the way they were taped, haphazardly, like, I'm in a hurry.
Later, Shannon would reveal to an informant exactly what happened on that bridge.
He said when he and his brother Joe threw Dan Short into the lake, Dan was begging, pleading for his life, and that he, Shannon, was laughing.
Time to go swimming? Ready to go swimming?
The autopsy confirmed that Dan Short was alive when he was shoved over the bridge into the inky water below.
They're pretty cruel people. I mean, who would kill somebody that way?
The brothers plead not guilty, insisting they were not involved. But the federal jury doesn't buy it.
In September of that year, both were convicted in federal trial, Springfield, Missouri, as charged.
There was a moratorium on the death penalty. And so they were given life in prison without parole.
Since the conviction in 1992 in federal trial, both Shannon and Joe have been in federal custody, serving their life without parole, plus 5-year sentences.
Investigators never do identify the alleged third accomplice with the small handprint who helped with the bank robbery, but they're confident that no others were involved in the murder.
Everybody in the county was relieved, but still mourned.
Justice is eventually done, and people who commit crimes need to remember that don't always get away with it.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.